from WABE in Atlanta. This is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. This is our daily look at the arts and culture of Atlanta and the creative minds behind it. Today, we're getting an idea of just how eclectic this weekend's AJC Decatur Book Festival is going to be. Henry Winkler will join us to talk about his series of books targeted at children with dyslexia. WABE's Amy Kiley sits down with public radio host and festival keynote speaker Brooke Gladstone. And first, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, right? My first guest today is renowned libations and hospitality expert Jerry Slater. He's written the forthcoming Southern Foodways Alliance Guide to Cocktails, which he's presenting along with co-author Sarah Camp Milam at this weekend's Decatur Book Festival. Jerry Slater, welcome back to City Lights.
Oh, it's so good to be here. That theme music, you know, I'm a big music fan, and it sort of reminded me, if I could just read one paragraph from the intro.
Oh, I was hoping you would.
So it says, drinking informs our music, too. This is an intro, you know, from the book about Southern drinking. Jazz, like the cocktail, is an American invention. We celebrate those who riff smartly on the classics, whether on the stage or behind the bar. Jelly Roll Morton, the jazz progenitor, began his career in the sporting houses of New Orleans where drinks flowed and prostitution flourished.
You know, that could not be a more fitting introduction to this. I mean, cocktails, uniquely American, and yes, that jazz happens to be by Dave Brubeck. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a variant of Take Five. It's called Far More Blue.
Yeah.
And I love it, and I'm glad that it inspired you to read that passage.
Well, in what I think is one of the great drinking places in America, I spent about 7 years in Louisville, Kentucky, and Dave Brubeck actually sat at the piano at the restaurant, the Oak Room at the Sealback that I managed in, and played the piano, and he felt more comfortable in the anteroom that we had, and sat and played the piano while he ate with his wife.
Oh, and
what a special place.
What did he sip? Do you remember?
I think he had a glass of wine.
There you go. Yeah, California, you know, that whole thing. Jerry, I must congratulate you. This book is beautifully produced and very useful. I think most impressive is that it reflects the Southern Foodways Alliance academic approach to the culture and anthropology of food. So how about if you tell us what makes a cocktail uniquely Southern?
Well, also from the intro is this one little paragraph, I think, and when Sarah Camp and I started talking about, you know, what we were going to include in the book, because the book has almost 20 bartenders from the Southeast. It has 88 cocktails.
I like that. It's one for each key on the piano.
There you go. And so we had to really think, you know, because we have a whole section that reflects the Manhattan, which you and I both love.
Yes,
and
my husband's favorite.
It's not necessarily a Southern drink, right? This is reflective of, you know, that wonderful island in the North. But yet, it's really taken hold in the South, and bartenders really riff on it, and we love it. So there's a whole section on that. Here's that paragraph I was telling you about. It says, the cocktails in this book meet one or more of the following criteria. One, they were conceived or popularized in the South. Two, they use Southern ingredients like peaches from Georgia or honeysuckle vodka from Mississippi. And three, they were concocted or recommended by some of the best bartenders in the region. Alongside the call-outs for Coca-Cola, Cheer Wine, and Kentucky Bourbon, you'll see recipes that incorporate Italian Amaros, French fortified wines, Mexican tequilas. Ours is a global South.
I love it. And so 21st century.
Yeah, we're really evolving, and that's one of the things I think the Southern Foodways Alliance does really well is document an emerging South. You know, nothing is meant to be an amber, as soon as you start to want to stratify it, I think you're going to lose something. So,
indeed. And what they have helped promote so beautifully is the shared culture of food, African Americans and Southern white Americans. And, you know, it just underscores how much we share. Yeah.
And in an emerging South, you know, this year's theme is El Sur Latino, you know, and so what's the next wave? What's the influence of the food going to be on the South? Because nothing ever sits still.
No, and I know there are sake tastings now.
Oh, sure. I love a good sake.
There we go. Well, just as cocktails suggest socializing, there's an interactive component to the book itself. Please tell us about the quiz.
So I actually just found this week as well. UGA Press, who put out the book, on their line, they did a PlayBuzz quiz about which cocktail you would be or which you would love, I guess.
Of course, a university press has to be gathering data. You know, this is scientific research.
Correct. So I went through there. I got the Creole Cresta, which is not even my drink. This is from a great bartender in Houston who we'll all be doing a benefit for shortly. Paul Calvert and Greg Best from Ticonderoga Club will be heading this up. So look out for that in the future. But this is from Alba Huerta, and her drink is kind of a spicy, updated version of a brandy crusta.
Oh, wow. Well, my result was the Bufala Negra. But as I was taking the quiz with my colleague and our producer, Mike Johns, there were so many decisions, because one of the things it asks is, what food do you like to snack most with? And I really needed to check all of the above. It had sweet, salty, savory.
Why do you have to pick?
Well, because they made it so that you had to choose one. So in thinking about what I'd like to snack with while sipping, salty one out. And I think that's how we ended up with the Bufala Negra, which looks gorgeous. And I understand these lovely ingredients are to make it.
A little birdie told me your results. thanks, Aaron. And so we brought the ingredients to make this drink. This drink is something that I created in about 2007 when Chef Todd Richards and Dwayne Nutter and I were going to the James Beard House. And
In Mississippi?
New York City.
Of course. Oh, Craig Claiborne.
Yeah.
I always get those guys.
This sort of Oscars of the food world, those guys.
Thank you.
So we were cooking there, and this is kind of a culinary spin on maybe an Italian mint julep in a way. We've got a little basil. We've got balsamic vinegar. This is 2007, before I'd ever heard of what a shrub was, ginger beer to top that off, and of course bourbon. So let's make one of these real quick. This is funny. This drink has kind of traveled around the world a little bit. It was published in a few magazines, and now people in Oakland and Leicester, England, and I saw somebody pop up in Australia. And when you know you have provenance over something, but you see it go out and take a life of its own, it's kind of fun.
Now, do you get a little kickback?
No.
No.
I think we're a little open source about this.
So. No intellectual property when it comes to creating cocktails.
I'm just kind of glad it's out there. You know, maybe just give credit. That would be cool.
That's a nice attitude.
So we not press too hard on this. We're muddling the basil, a little brown sugar, the balsamic. Mm. And, of course, we got to put some bourbon in here.
Yes. Kentucky's own.
I did bring a towel because I'm making a mess here in the studio.
Oh, that's okay. Our studio's never enjoyed such things. But usually it's just crumbs from us that we, you know, pizza crusts we leave flavor on, which are quite tasty. I would eat pizza crusts with my drinks too.
Well, and I've got to admit, I'm a little more nervous today. I'm opening for the Fonz. That's amazing. sound, right?
It is a wonderful sound. And here, Jerry is dipping into the ice.
Ooh. We're all friends here. That ice scoop not included.
No, we are. Oh, there you go.
And then we're going to top this with a little ginger beer.
This is what really distinguishes a mixologist from a bartender, don't you think? Yes. This is a work of art being created before us.
So you hear that little tap, we just, the fresh herbs like mint, or this is topped with basil, you give it a little smack just to release the oils.
Oh, yes.
So you smell that.
I smell the basil. Okay. Can I sip it?
Please.
That's heavenly.
Oh, nice. Thank
that
you.
That is heavenly. Can I finish it? No. No. Producers say no, she cannot down this. Before I tell you that, if you are just joining us, you're listening to City Lights. I'm Lois Brightsis, and I'm already schnockered after one sip. My guest, Jerry Slater, previews the Southern Foodways Alliance Guide to Cocktails with co-author Sarah Camp Milam at this weekend's Decatur Book Festival. We'll be back after a short break.
Support for WABE comes from Capital One. You can open a Capital One savings account and discover more about Capital One savings online at CapitalOne.com/ReimagineAtlanta. Capital One, welcome to banking reimagined. And from DK Gallery, the contemporary fine art gallery on the Marietta Square, presenting 1,000 words at First Friday Art Walk and Art Talk plus poetry readings this Saturday, 2 to 4, dkgallery.us.
We're back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. Our guest is Jerry Slater. He's co-author of the forthcoming Southern Foodways Alliance Guide to Cocktails. And since it is in front of me, is it still forthcoming?
The official release is October 5th.
Ah.
Get that pre-order on Amazon.
Right.
But we are previewing it tomorrow at Decatur Book Fest. So Sarah Camp and I will be on stage at 5:30 on the culinary stage on the square. And there will be copies for sale there.
Okay. So. We were talking about the sociability of sipping, and I think it's probably fair to say that most people enjoy sipping with their significant others or friends. And the last time you visited, Jerry, I was telling you my husband's favorite drink is a Manhattan. Can a Manhattan be Southern? You know, you were talking about it at the beginning of the program. How does an iconic drink become Southern?
Well, I think that's it fits at least two of the three categories that we set up, right? It's made in the South. It's made with now ingredients in the South. Maybe when the Manhattan first came around, there was a lot of rye whiskey being made in Pennsylvania, in New York City, or in the surrounding areas of New York City. But nowadays, most of that rye whiskey is being made in Kentucky. There is this wonderful little distilling revolution happening with small distilleries. I think there's at least one in every of the 50 states now. But, you know, a lot of it's still being made in Kentucky. So when it's being made by somebody in the South, it's being made with Southern ingredients, that fits at least two of those three, even if it wasn't created here.
So. And what you just mentioned about the revolution in distilleries, and we've seen the growth of microbreweries, and, of course, wine coming from regions that weren't known for wine before. Again, it's all so reaffirming about America, about the United States taking its rightful place in cuisine, in drinks.
Yeah, well, I think we had a little bit of a setback with Prohibition, and it took us a while to climb out of that hole. But as things are starting to loosen up, and you're seeing wonderful wines. We took a trip through Virginia wine country, which is amazing now, top quality that would rival California. Micro distillery just spent time with friends in Charleston, South Carolina, who own a distillery called Highwire right on King Street. You know, and as you come around to thinking on this, you know, if you're going to eat local, we're very much involved with the culinary tradition. Why not drink local as well?
Sure.
Yeah.
Your wife is a sommelier, isn't it? Sommelier?
I always have trouble with that one, too. Yes, very much so. And, yeah, she was the impetus for the recent Virginia wine trip. And she actually did some illustrations that were going to be in the book, but are now going to be used as promo material. So wine person and artist. Mentioning art in the book, just give a shout out to Andrew Thomas Lee, local photographer.
Beautiful.
Aren't these great?
They are great. And I also must acknowledge that you have a section for teetotalers.
We do. Some things like a church lady punch, I think it's called. Yeah, you know, you can't always imbibe, but you still maybe want to commune over a social bowl.
Exactly. Or just share in the conviviality of a toast.
Yeah.
And I must not overlook the recipes for snacks, all of which, you know, can fit any of those categories that I was going to check for what goes best with a cocktail.
It's got a little bit of all of that in there. And yeah, just the back section, we couldn't give you drinks without feeding you. This is from Vishbot in Oxford, Mississippi at Snack Bar. And what an amazing collection of recipes that are both Southern but also reflect his Indian culture as well. And just wait till you see, you know, okra, you know, what we consider a Southern ingredient, done in an Indian style. I mean, just beautiful.
And again, so quintessentially American, because these influences come from everywhere. And I must congratulate you on this beautiful publication, the book you wrote with Sarah Camp Milam for the Southern Foodways Alliance. We've been talking with beverage master Jerry Slater, not just mixologist. I think of you as the Meister Mixer.
Well, thank you.
The Meister Mixer of cocktails. Jerry Slater will be at the Decatur Book Festival along with Sarah Camp Milam, the Southern Foodways Alliance managing editor, to preview their guide to cocktails tomorrow evening at 5:30 on the cooking and food stage. Thank you again, and cheers.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Support for WABE comes from Reliable Heating and Air, a Train dealer, a family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com. And from Vacasa, employing professional teams to provide local care for vacation homes and guests. Services include reservations, housekeeping, and instant online booking. More than 5,000 vacation homes are available online at vacasa.com.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. The AJC Decatur Book Festival kicks off tonight with a panel called Journalism in Our Current Environment. Public radio host and author Brooke Gladstone will participate. Her new book is called The Trouble with Reality: A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Our own Amy Kiley spoke with Gladstone about the book and the panel.
Let's start with the title of your book. What is the trouble with reality?
That was meant in two ways, that reality is a problem and there's a problem with reality, meaning that Reality is a complicated issue, not a straightforward one. It means something different for every person because we each construct our own based on our values and our background and our history and our culture and a whole bunch of other things. And facts don't determine reality. They're an element in it, but they have to be marinated in all those other things before we cook up a reality for ourselves. So that's the trouble with reality, that it's such a sticky wicket. And there's also the fact that reality is in trouble because people are feeling so confused and so unmoored by our current time.
How do we even know what is fact and what is fake?
We do know facts. We can go to good, reliable sources. We can examine how they determine what is what. It's how we assemble them where we get into problems. And of course, there are things that we simply choose to ignore or even to deny if it conflicts directly with the view of the world that we've constructed for ourselves, because it's painful to tinker with your reality. You know, you could break it.
And you write that President Trump put a half Nelson chokehold on reality. How did he do that?
I'm not blaming Trump for our reality being screwed up. It's always been somewhat screwed up, but he took advantage of situations that are baked into human beings. Our ability to function in the world depends on filtering out things. And he was able to encourage people to continue doing that by driving home the idea with every lie that he speaks that a fact is a choice. He empowers you to basically deny what it is you choose not to believe, not to cope with it, not to reckon with it, simply to argue that it doesn't exist. And he does this by taking the engines of accountability that we've always relied on, organizations that assemble data, whether it's the Environmental Protection Agency or the Centers for Disease Control, or most importantly, the media, and simply saying that every single one of those bodies has a political agenda that overrides all the work they do. And therefore, the information they provide is a lie. The truth itself is a liar.
Our listeners have heard NPR political correspondent Mara Liasson fact check President Trump over and over and over again. Given what you just said, is all that fact checking just futile?
Fact-checking is never futile. It is essential in order to create an informed electorate. The crucial thing is to place those facts into a context that is meaningful for the listener. You may hear a fact and it'll prove that Donald Trump is a liar, right? But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it has no effect on you. And if you are in agreement with his general worldview. So when you choose a fact to check, you need to present it in a way that is meaningful to a person, that will have an influence, an impact on the way that they live. And that is much harder than simply saying, you know, he said it didn't rain during his inauguration speech, but in fact he did. Here's the weather report. Here's the pictures. Here are the umbrellas. You know, people will say, you know what? All politicians lie, so it doesn't matter if he lies, unless he lies about something that is vitally important to you personally and your family and the world you live in.
Nonprofits like Public Radio aside, you point out that the news is a business, and businesses are about making money, not always telling the truth. Are for-profit news organizations distorting reality or facts for profit?
No, and I don't say actually in the book that they lie to make money. What I'm saying is that they emphasize certain things that will appeal to their audiences. There's enormous amount of distortion that goes on in some precincts of the media, but the media It's a plural. It's not a unitary institution. You can't put the New York Times and Breitbart and National Public Radio and Fox News in the same basket and call it the media. You need to be honest with yourself and really determine, based on the work that they've done, the important work they've done, and how they deal with the mistakes they make, how they own up to them. What is their process? Do they let you in? You have to find the media that are far less likely to distort or to omit, or that don't do it on purpose. I mean, there are still journalistic values, principally fairness and accuracy. And whether or not it's an advocacy newspaper, they can still be fair and accurate. Places with a point of view can produce really good information. Places without a point of view can certainly produce bad information. I would say that this media environment provides the best and the worst information that we've ever had in American history.
Your book touches on stereotypes in a way that seems to speak to the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. One, how do stereotypes factor into this perspective of reality that you're trying to lay out? And in your book, you argue that President Trump used and even kind of freed, I think, this prejudice toward a list of groups. And how did he use those stereotypes?
Stereotypes are shortcuts that we use. Walter Lippmann, a famous social critic and newspaper man back in the 20s, wrote a book called Public Opinion, which is brilliant. You know, essentially, he was the first person to use the word stereotypes in the modern sense. What he's saying is that we will use a shortcut by taking a single characteristic about a person or a group and then kind of fill in the rest of the blanks and assume that we know them. Oh, they're from Baton Rouge. That tells us all we need to know. Oh, they're from Brooklyn. Oh, they're an investment banker. They're a kindergarten teacher. They're black. They're white. And so on. These kinds of things stand in for a whole lot more and provides a very monolithic portrait of groups that are rich in detail and are very specific. Now, the way that Trump used them during the campaign was simply to create a view of the world and the way it works that a certain part of the population was inclined to believe. And so he said, you know, you have these problems because there are immigrants taking your job. And this is even when employment is booming in the country, but not in those places that have not been served by their government and have been forgotten, really, by both parties. So these people were disinclined to believe anything that traditional politicians told them anyway. So he said, here, I can explain what your problem is. It's these immigrants, or it's these people of color. Or it's the Jews, you know, and then he'd say, and we have this terrible crime because of these people, even though crime is at historic lows, except for a handful of cities where there's been an uptick. He'll create an environment that is untrue or is not contextualized in order to build this reality that seems to speak to the problems of people who have been ignored by traditional politics.
In a democracy, the reality is the people who bothered to vote elected President Trump. So isn't that just a fact we should all accept as reality?
Oh, sure. People who bothered to vote elected President Trump. And people who decided to stay home or decided to make their vote a statement of morality rather than to use their vote strategically also enabled the election of Donald Trump, who, as we all know, didn't win the most votes. But given the peculiarities of our electoral college system and the way we apportion votes, he became a minority president.
What would you say to people who did cast those votes and who still support the president and who say, my reality is fine. At the Decatur Book Festival, I know you're hosting a panel on the importance of journalism, the importance of that fact-checking. What do you say to the people who hold, no, the way I see facts, that's just fine for me?
I would say that those people are the are just like everybody else. You don't want to change your beliefs until you have no choice. So unless or until those people determine that the promises he made won't be fulfilled, unless or until those people decide that the image he reflects is one that they can no longer identify with, they will hold fast to the world that he created, which is one that reflected their sense of injury and grievance. Now, I have to say, and I think it bears repeating, obviously he won by a slender margin. Certainly of the popular vote, he didn't win at all. And it was a relatively slender margin in the electoral system, right? So who was the principal voter for Donald Trump? It was the Mitt Romney voter. It was a person who decided that, you know, maybe they don't agree with his worldview. Maybe they don't care that he plays fast and loose with the facts. He's a Republican and he'll probably keep their taxes down. And that was the thing that they were most interested in. Until and unless those voters decide that perhaps favorable tax rates aren't worth the cost, they won't change their votes either.
Any final words of advice for a public radio listener who does want to know the facts as part of their reality, who's listening to this conversation and thinks, what could I do?
You mean to stay tethered to the facts? I've been in public radio a long time. I have enormous respect for public radio listeners. And the thing that I respect most is that they are engaged in the world, whatever politics they have. And I think, at least the last I looked, about a third of public radio listeners called themselves conservatives. So they're curious enough to listen to a radio network that has been decried by the right as, you know, irretrievably leftist. And, you know, and I applaud them. And I think those who are on the liberal side of the spectrum ought to seek out responsible views that are all around them that don't exactly reflect their own image back at them. I think public radio tries to mix it up with a wide variety of voices, but there are plenty of other places to go. I mean, go to the National Review online or commentary. You may not agree with what they say, but you can read well-reasoned arguments there, and it'll at least help you understand what it is that may have happened that you didn't see coming. I mean, the reason why I wrote this book is because a publisher came to me and said, you know, we really want you to write about this moment because people seem so more upset than they've ever been before. And I have to say, I'm no spring chicken, and I've seen plenty of presidents that people didn't like voted in, and never this level of distress. And I felt that the distress level was much less tied to politics than it was to a sense that the country and, in fact, the world didn't work according to the principles that we thought it did, among them that facts can change people's minds. So what I tried to do in The Trouble with Reality is to describe how it is we construct our worlds and how it was that Trumpism found it not nearly as hard as those of us in our bubbles might have thought it would be to take hold and at least prevail during the election, if not after.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Public radio host and author Brooke Gladstone spoke with WABE's Amy Kiley. Gladstone will participate in a panel discussion tonight called Journalism in Our Current Environment. It's part of the AJC Decatur Book Festival, and she'll discuss her new book at a separate festival event tomorrow.
Support for WABE comes from the Atlanta Botanical Garden, where you can see nature in a whole new way during The Curious Garden. This unique exhibition, presented through October 29th, features a dozen surprising displays designed to make you stop, think about, and talk about plants, gardens, and nature like never before. For details, visit atlantabg.org. WABE attracts the region's most affluent, educated, and engaged individuals. Underwriting with WABE is an effective way to reach this influential audience while supporting WABE's award-winning public media. Online at WABE.org.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Wrights. It's great to be with you. Known most famously, and he is still proud of being the Fonz from Happy Days. Henry Winkler is also 10 books into his children's book series, Here's Hank, that he co-writes with Lynn Oliver. The newest in the series is Here's Hank, Hooray! My butt left the bench. The main character in this series is elementary schooler Hank Zipser, and Hank has dyslexia. Henry is in town for the AJC Decatur Book Festival as the keynote speaker. Henry Winkler, welcome back to City Lights.
We're very happy to be here, and thanks for turning the lights on for me.
Oh, we are so excited to have you on City Lights. You and Stacy have brightened our lights before. Now, as we discussed the last time you were here, the Here's Hank series is very personal for you because you also have dyslexia.
Yes.
In the books you've written so far, would you tell us some of the similarities between you and the character of Hank?
The emotionality in all of the books that we have written, to date 32 novels, the emotion is absolutely true. I can remember what it was like to be Hank in second grade or in third, fourth, and fifth grade. And it comes out of me like a river. The humor is exaggerated. We make that up. And the most important thing for us in writing these books is to write a comedy. Where it is not a self-help book. These are meant to make those children laugh, whether they have a challenge or not. And my partner, Lynn, is always happy to say every child has some sort of challenge.
Yeah.
Height or pimples or athletics, not necessarily just academics.
So the humor, you said, was not there for you, and yet you overcame the academic setbacks and became this iconic comic actor.
You know what it is? I think more important than geometry is will. I live by tenacity and gratitude. Tenacity has gotten me here to this microphone with you today, and everything in between, and gratitude doesn't allow you to be angry all the time when things are not going your way. You just pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you keep moving, you know?
In reading about your background, it was sad, I mean, painful to discover that when you were already famous on Happy Days, you had difficulty reading scripts.
Yes, that's true.
When were you diagnosed?
I was never diagnosed. Stacy's son that came as a gift with the marriage, Jed, came into my life when he was 4. In the third grade, we had him tested. And everything that they said about Jed was true about me. And I went, oh, my goodness, I'm not stupid. I'm not lazy. I've got something with a name. And all of that arguing, all of that grounding, all of that punishment and shame was for nothing.
And so when did you decide to write these Hank books?
Do you know what? It was 2003. I met Lynn over lunch. But I didn't even know what I was doing, because the first time it was suggested, I completely dismissed the idea. I was convinced there was no way I knew what to do, I had a story to tell, or that I could even accomplish it. And then a few months later, same man, Alan Berger in L.A., said, I'm telling you, I'm going to introduce you to my friend Lynn, write books for kids about your learning challenges. And this time I was smart enough to say, you know what, I'm just going to try. And out of that came 34 novels.
The books themselves, I mean, the actual production and appearance are specifically designed for children with dyslexia. Could you explain the dyslexia font?
Yes. Now, these are Here's Hank. Here's Hank is for first, second, and third grade. My grandson, Ace, is read to at bedtime, and he loves Hank. He loves the stories. I just wanted to throw that in. It makes me happy.
Does he play poker?
He does not play poker.
Okay.
But he is sly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, so the reading, to learn to read, is such a difficult process anyway, for the mind and the eye to line up, to become friends. I wish I had this font, this printing style. A dad in Holland, who is dyslexic himself, he's a graphic artist. He developed this font that we use. We're the first ones in America to ever use it. For his children.
And I know he named it dyslexia, but I thought it should be called the fancy font.
Yeah, the fancy font, or even the font that makes your eyes happy.
And why? What is it about that style?
So let's say the D, the ascending line of the D is a little longer. The Y, the descending line of the Y is a little longer. The space of the opening of the C, the lettering, the weight of the letters, the spacing. If you look at this font, whether you have a learning challenge or not, it is so welcoming, it is so soothing, that this difficulty that one has in learning to read is made easier. Everybody should have this font, whether you've got a learning challenge or not. I truly believe that. I looked at it the first time, and I was 70 years old. And I thought to myself, oh, look at this. This is amazing. I wish I had this when I was growing up.
It's important that we distinguish not a disability, which not until all that long ago it was still called a learning disability,
That's
LD
right.
kids.
That's right.
Then it became learning differences.
That's right.
Why is that change in descriptor so important?
I'll tell you why. Because it is not a disability. It is the wiring of the brain. It is the way the DNA, the all the X's and the Y's have lined up. It is hereditary. It is passed on from generation to generation. Lots of parents are embarrassed that their kid is not up to snuff. I went to a school visit today, just before I came here. I was at the Howard School here in Atlanta. Oh, my God.
You were invited back because of your previous talk.
What a gift. Those children were amazing, alive and vibrant and inquisitive. It was just a great experience. I get as much out of it as hopefully the children do.
And the children don't necessarily know you from your acting. They know you as the author of Here's Hank, the co-author.
That's right.
With Lynn of Here's Hank.
That's right.
So how do they relate to you? I mean, are they just interested in talking about the content of the
book?
Not
at all. You know what? They would talk to me about the age-old problem that if you're a different, if you have a difference in your body, in your mind as a little kid, you are bullied. They wanted to know, was I bullied? And I asked them, I said, okay, now let me just ask you a question. Are you a good friend? Yes. Are you a smart person? Yes. Are you wonderful to your parents? Yes. So that you are an incredibly terrific human being on the earth. If that's true, nobody can bully you. They can say words to you, but those words will bounce off you like rubber because you know inside you're great.
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights. We're speaking with the great Henry Winkler about his series with Lynn Oliver of children's books, Here's Hank. We'll be back after a short break. And we're back with City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes speaking with Henry Winkler about his series of children's books, Here's Hank. Henry is also the keynote speaker at this year's AJC Decatur Book Festival. So the new book is Hooray, My Butt Left the Bench.
Yes.
Tell us the story.
Hank wants to play basketball.
So badly.
But Hank and I, we don't have really good eye-hand coordination. I was never an athlete until I started fly fishing for trout. And I'm not very good at that either, but I catch my fish, and I love it. So he tries out because his best friends, Frankie and Ashley, are picked to be on the team for a very big game, the game against PS91. They play every year, and PS87 has won. That's Hank's school, and they want to maintain the win. They want a tripeat or trip, you know, the three-peat. I knew there was something in there.
Chicago Bulls did that.
Yes, right.
A few times.
Yes, and so will PS87.
Go, Hank.
Okay. So Hank wants to try out, and he does, but Miss Adolph, the worst teacher on the planet, the
fourth
grade.
I like the choice of name.
Yeah, but that was my real teacher. It was her name.
Seriously?
She was gray.
Oh,
her
God.
Bun was gray. Her breath were gray.
Her mustache.
Her knee was gray. Everything was gray. And she is the coach. So he's got to try out for Miss Adolph. And he dribbles the ball once. It works. Twice. It's working. The third time it hits his toe and bounces all over the gym. He doesn't know how he is going to convince or even scare Miss Adolph to pick him for the team. He said, you know, I could get rid of her. Then it could be like a whole new coach, but how? I could go to the school loudspeaker, announce that her pet cat, Fang, needs her home to take care of a kitty litter emergency. Maybe she would leave. I'd get on the team. You don't know.
And you have to read the book.
Yes. He is a bench warmer, but there is a moment.
Ah.
He becomes the secret weapon.
And part of what is so thrilling about that, this is not a complete spoiler alert, but Hank's greatest contribution is that he is assisting.
That's right.
In the victory.
And He becomes a secret weapon for the PS87 basketball team. Who knew?
Who knew if he could only get his butt off the bench?
Yes. And the star of the team is Heather Payne, who later on in the series becomes a peer tutor, and he wants to know why he would be tutored by a fruit. And they go, no, not a pear, a peer tutor.
Well, one other thing that I think is so impressive, Heather, okay, we have a girl who's the star.
The star.
And Hank's best friends, one is African-American, one is
Asian-American.
Of Asian background.
Right.
And they are not dyslexic.
No.
So you are imparting some very important messages, not so subtly, to an 8-year-old's mind.
Well, you know what we get in a lot of letters is not only how did you know me so well, but they love the kids who read these books, whether they are dyslexic or not. They read these books and love Frankie and Ashley, his best friends, because they don't judge him. They love him. They get together downstairs in his apartment building in New York City. In one of the storage rooms is their clubhouse. It's right next to the laundry room, so they are constantly smelling their clothes smell like suds. But they have a great time, and they try to help Hank, but Hank believes that his imagination has got personality.
I think your imagination and personality have had a whole lot to do with a lot of kids' success since being diagnosed with dyslexia. We only have a minute left, but I was just hoping you could tell us in the minute about this new series. You went back to Berlin with Stacy.
Yes. It's called Better Late Than Never. It was on NBC last year. Terry Bradshaw, Bill Shatner, George Foreman, and Jeff Dye, a stand-up comic. We traveled across the world. This year, it was Germany and Spain, Sweden, Lithuania, and Marrakesh. And we are fish out of water. And in Germany, I went on a scavenger hunt and discovered my heritage.
And we can look forward to seeing that in the winter?
Yes, in I believe in January, but don't hold me to it.
Okay.
Better late than never.
Well, I will hold you to this. I hope you and Stacy will come back, and that goes for Lynn as well. And also, we should add for listeners that Henry Winkler is the executive producer of MacIver,
which is shot right here in Atlanta.
Another feather in our local cap. Thank you so much. The new Hank Zipser series edition is Hooray, My Butt Left the Bench. The Kid Note speech is sold out, but we are so grateful that people could hear you live here on WAB.
Well, we always have a wonderful time in this studio.
Thank you again.
Thanks for inviting us.
Support for WABE comes from The Fresh Market, offering a refreshed store experience with premium meat, seasonal produce, signature baked goods, and meals to go. Learn more at thefreshmarket.com/refresh. And from Wellstar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal Distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. Wellstar.org.
You've been listening to City Lights, and you can catch an encore broadcast tonight at 8. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. Our MVP of radio is Christine Dempsey. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks so much for joining us for City Lights and for listening to WABE, Atlanta's Choice. For NPR, have a safe and good holiday weekend.